home's in heaven. I'm going there. I'm going where there's no depression. A better land is free from care. I'll leave this world, toil and trouble. Home's in heaven. I'm going there. I'm going where there's no depression. To a better land that's free from care. I'll leave this world a toil and trouble. My home's in heaven. I'm going there.
Country DJs knows that I'm an outlaw. They'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. Loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings and my hair. I guess he ain't read the signs that say I've been to prison. Someone ought to warn him before I knock him off his chair. 'Cause my long hair just can't cover up my redneck. I've won every fight I've ever fought, and I don't need some turkey telling me that I ain't country, saying I ain't worth a damn dough ticket that he bought. 'Cause I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. They tell me I look like Merle Haggard and sound a lot like David Allen Coe. And the barmaid in the last town that we played in knew the words to every song I'd wrote. She said Jimmy Rabbit turned her on to my last album just about the time the jukebox broke. Yeah, Johnny Cash helped me get out of prison long before Rodriguez stole that goat. I've been the Rhinestone Cowboy for so long I can't remember, and I can do you every song Hank Williams ever wrote. And I can sing all them songs about Texas, and I still do all the sad ones that I know. I can't help it, I look like Merle Haggard, and I sound a lot like David Allen Coe. But the country DJs all think I'm an outlaw, and they'd never come to see me in this dive, where bikers stare at cowboys who are laughing at the hippies who are praying they'll get out of here alive. The loudmouth in the corner's getting to me, talking about my earrings.
Hey, a little David Allen Coe wrapping up that set of music with Long-Haired Redneck here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Before the David Allen Coe, Uncle Tupelo in that set of music from their No Depression album, the title track, a Carter Family tune. Before the Uncle Tupelo, the man in black himself from Unchained, Johnny Cash doing Soundgarden's Rusty Cage. Also played some Bow Wow Wow in that set. Their song Cowboy kind of fit within the overall umbrella of what that set was sounding like. And speaking of which, from their second album, The Pretenders 2, it was The Pretenders, starting off the entire set with Bad Boys Get Spanked. Gets us here where we've got about a minute and a half before we're at the top of the hour. While I'm on this kind of theme, Can we call it a theme? It's a theme. And no matter when you roll out of bed, I got to remind you that whiskey before breakfast will suit your every need. You can join Mando Richard for Pittsburgh's most eclectic folk radio show, Whiskey Before Breakfast, right here on WRCT. Now, each week, the show kicks off on the liquored up side of the family, and then it wraps up on the gospel side. And in between...
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Well, it has been a very consequential 24 hours for Donald Trump, for the Justice Department, for the January 6th committee. We have so many pieces of breaking news to talk about, and I want to start first and foremost with a federal judge's opinion that Donald Trump likely committed multiple felonies in trying to overturn the results of the 2020 election. Now, we're going to talk about what this means and what it doesn't mean. And many of you correctly writing to me and saying, David, wait, a judge determines whether Trump is guilty? Doesn't a jury do that? This is not a determination of criminality for the purposes of punishment. Donald Trump has not been charged. The context here is evidence. And does there appear to be a legitimate reason to turn over certain records on the basis that it seems reasonable that Donald Trump committed crimes and thus the evidence is legitimate to be looked at by investigators? And we're going to talk about that, and we have some very specific comments about this from legal experts. Let's start with the New York Times article. Federal judge finds Trump most likely committed crimes over the 2020 election. The judge wrote in a civil case, the illegality of the plan was obvious. Separately, the January 6th panel voted to recommend contempt of Congress charges for two former Trump aides. This article is worth reading in its entirety. The important points here, a federal judge ruled yesterday that Trump and a lawyer who advised him on how to overturn the 2020 election most likely had committed felonies, including obstructing the work of Congress and conspiring to defraud the United States. The judge's comments on the civil case of the lawyer John Eastman marked a significant breakthrough for the House committee investigating the riots. The committee is weighing making a criminal referral to the Justice Department, had used a filing in the case to lay out the crimes it believed Trump might have committed. Importantly, Trump has not been charged with any crime. The judge's ruling has no immediate practical legal effect on him, but it ratifies the committee's argument that Trump's efforts to block Congress from certifying Biden's win could well rise to the level of a criminal conspiracy. This is, we can't let this be normalized. It is outrageous that this is what is going on. Judge David Carter wrote, quote, the illegality of the plan was obvious. Our nation was founded on the peaceful transition of power, epitomized by George Washington laying down his sword to make way for democratic elections. Ignoring this history, President Trump vigorously campaigned for the vice president to single-handedly determine the result of the 2020 election. So what are our questions here? Well, the first question is, does this finally give the Attorney General Merrick Garland a way to move forward with the criminal charges? And the answer is, it probably does, but he probably won't. Now, what's really important to understand here is, what does this mean? This is not a judge ruling that a crime was committed. That's for a jury to do if charges are brought. But I asked former FBI special agent, who's now a lawyer, Asha Rangappa, she teaches at Yale Law School. I asked her about this on Twitter, and she explained very clearly, quote, the judge's opinion isn't itself evidence of a crime. It's an evaluation of some of the evidence, which is the grand jury's job. I'd say at most, it suggests that a grand jury would be able to independently find probable cause to charge, but the problem is proving it beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. Asha went on to add, the judge may have just been stating what was obvious from the evidence, but no doubt it's a major flag that this had better be an active Department of Justice investigation, dereliction of duty if it is not. So this is the main point, and we've been talking about this for some time. I don't think anybody is arguing, or let me put it a different way. Due process holds that one is innocent until proven guilty. And due process holds that we can't say someone should be punished for a crime until they've been found guilty of a crime. And right now, Donald Trump has not even been charged. So we're, you know, the right loves to say they're all about law and order, but they will immediately suspend due process when they want someone, quote, locked up. Think Hillary Clinton. We're not going to do that. We're going to stick to due process. But what is abundantly clear at this point is we have endless opinions, including now from a federal judge, that it's at least quite plausible that felonies have been committed. And so what does that mean? It doesn't mean you throw someone in jail before getting a guilty verdict, but it does mean there should be an active investigation. And Asha Rangappa is completely correct about that. So this ruling affects a very specific part of the process of investigation. It relates to a civil case. It's not time for jail. We're not saying lock anybody up. It's the right that loves to do that by skipping due process. But what we are saying is if there's no investigation going on right now, it raises some major, major questions that we need to have answered. And unfortunately, what we saw in Manhattan is very similar to this. Remember that Mark Pomerantz and another prosecutor investigating Trump criminally in Manhattan resigned. And initially, many on the right were saying they resigned because they knew that it was all bogus and there was nothing to investigate. No, we speculated, and it's since been confirmed, they resigned because they actually thought, wow, Trump did commit crimes, and it doesn't seem there's any interest in actually charging him. And so our work is essentially being done for nothing. We found evidence of criminality. Nobody's interested in charging the guy. I'm out of here. That's what happened. So we're seeing the same story. Federal judge, civil case, Manhattan investigators, everybody coming to the conclusion felonies were probably committed here. Will he be charged? I'm not particularly optimistic. This is just an unbelievable story. After months and months of wrangling, trying to avoid providing call records to the House committee investigating the January 6th Trump riots, the Trump White House, the former White House, finally provided the call records to the January 6th committee. Great, right? I mean, what delightful. They've got the information they need. No. The January 6th call logs provided by Trump to the committee have a 7-hour gap on January 6th, the key hours during which it is crucial and critical to understand who is Trump speaking to. Now, there's a second layer to this, which is they may have had phone calls that they never put in the log. So there's kind of two layers of accountability. The first is give us the log so we can see who you spoke to. That assumes the logs are accurate. And I would not assume that with this former administration. But the next part of it is, of course, well, do the calls even reflect what they should reflect? Washington Post report, very good report by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. January 6th White House logs given to the House show a 7-hour gap. Wow. The House Select Committee is now investigating whether it has the full record and whether Trump communicated that day through back channels, phones of aides, or personal disposable phones. Now, Trump is claiming he doesn't know what a burner phone is. I don't believe that for a second. We're going to get to that in a moment. Read the whole article. We're linking to it. Internal White House records from the day of the attack that were turned over to the House Select Committee show a gap in Trump's phone logs of 7 hours and 37 minutes, including, what a surprise, the period when the building was being violently assaulted, according to documents obtained by the Washington Post and CBS News. The lack of an official White House notation of any calls placed to or by Trump for 457 minutes Look at the time here from 11:17 a.m. to 6:54 p.m. I'm trying to think, what was going on during that time? Oh, right. That was exactly when the Capitol was taken over by violent insurrectionists attempting to overturn the results of the election. Well, during that time, we don't have the logs. That means the committee has no record of his phone conversations as his supporters descended on the Capitol, battled overwhelmed police, and forcibly entered the building, prompting lawmakers and VP Mike Pence to flee for safety. The 11 pages of records, which consist of the president's official daily diary and the White House switchboard call logs, were turned over by the National Archives earlier this year. The records show Trump was active on the phone for part of the day, documenting conversations with at least 8 people in the morning and 11 in the evening. But there is this 7-hour gap that stands in stark contrast to the extensive public reporting about phone calls he had with allies during the attack. We know he spoke to Mike Lee, he spoke to Tommy Tuberville, he spoke to Kevin McCarthy, and many others. So, in essence, they didn't really turn over the records in that we don't actually have the records, or the White House doesn't, during those key moments. Now, I want to talk about this burner thing. This is now from a CBS News article. Remember that this was a kind of joint report from Washington Post and CBS. The House panel is now investigating whether Trump communicated through back channels, meaning he could have used other people's phones or personal disposable phones known as burner phones. Look at this. In a statement Monday night, Trump said, "I have no idea what a burner phone is. To the best of my knowledge, I have never even heard the term." Does anybody believe that? Does anybody believe that Donald Trump doesn't know what a burner phone is? I know he's not the brightest, but there is no doubt that he knows what a burner phone is. The stuff that Trump has been up to for so long. Now, is it possible he doesn't know it by that name? He knows it as a disposable phone. I don't know, guys. Maybe. But this is not believable. And when we talk about, remember when we spoke about the Ukraine fiasco that led to the second impeachment? Remember when we spoke about the entire Russia probe, quite frankly? As I've said before, if from the beginning of the suspicions about Russia, the Mueller investigation, the entire thing, much of what took place was self-inflicted harm done by Trump. If Trump hadn't gone public and tweeted all sorts of things that attracted more attention to the story, if Trump hadn't gone overboard in his denials, and then it came out, actually, they met with all of these Russian individuals and all these different things, the investigation would never have become what it was. And similarly, when it comes to January 6th, it is increasingly plausible that had Trump just cooperated, and not called attention to the fact that he's obviously trying to cover up the full scope of what he did and what he said and who he spoke to that day, this also likely would not be as big as it is. Because, to be perfectly frank, my opinion is whatever is in those missing 7.5 hours, it's probably not good. But if you don't have the contents of those calls, you have a circumstantial case at best, most likely. And again, the fact that there is a 7.5 hour gap in the records at exactly the key time that's being investigated is just putting more of a focus on that time and suggesting that Donald Trump knows that he did something wrong. So I'm not suggesting Trump is innocent, but what I am suggesting is that the cover up after the fact actions are putting more of a spotlight. When you don't give 7.5 hours of logs, you're saying these are the 7.5 hours that you want to focus on. Now, unfortunately, and I know we continue to have this discussion, you and I in the audience, it's not looking to me like there are going to be any consequences here. Number one, there seems to be no willingness on the part of any prosecutor to actually look at criminal charges for any of what's taken place. And number two, listen, Trump is pretty Teflon. It's just the reality. And he's thinking about running again in 2024. There's the possibility that even running again may be part of keeping himself out of trouble by being back in power. And I remain pessimistic about accountability here. But in the last 24 hours, just incredible stories and a 7.5 hour gap in the phone records. If you believe that we are finally getting to where it's overwhelming, there are going to be consequences, let me know. You can find me on Twitter at Deep Hackman and let me know what you think is coming. The David Pakman Show is primarily made possible by viewers and listeners like you who sign up on our website for the membership program. We do an extra show every day for our members, and I would love for you to sign up. You know, we very often kind of don't even think about the fact that we contribute a few bucks a month to all sorts of channels whose politics we may not agree with. If you have a cable TV subscription, you are contributing a few bucks a month to some channels I guarantee you, you don't like. And we should think about contributing a couple bucks to programs we actually do like and want to support. And you can do that by signing up at joinpakman.com. And you can use the coupon code WOW22 to get a discount. I want to talk about sort of a media story that's been created out of something that Joe Biden recently said, which I agree with completely. And I believe that it's being deliberately misinterpreted. The other day, Joe Biden said, Putin can't remain in power. Putin can't remain in power. And Joe Biden was correct. And what Joe Biden obviously meant when he said it was, this guy's a disaster. This guy's terrible for his own people. This guy has invaded another country and is leading to the deaths of, I don't even want to say whether it's thousands or tens of thousands, or I mean, we just don't know right now the amount of death that is being caused by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. And Joe Biden said, this guy can't remain in power. And Joe Biden was not saying we're going to invade Russia. Joe Biden was not saying we're going to assassinate Putin. Joe Biden was not saying we're going to effect regime change in Russia. He wasn't saying any of those things. Now, has the U.S. done things like that in the past? Of course. But it's not what Joe Biden said, and it's very clearly not what Joe Biden meant. I agree, Putin can't remain in power, but it's not up to us to take him out of power. But Putin can't remain in power. It would be better for the world for Putin not to be in power. It'd be better for the world for Rodrigo Duterte not to be in power. It'd be better for Kim Jong-un not to be in power. Bolsonaro, Maduro. I mean, there's lots of leaders where I would say, this guy can't remain in power. This is not good. But that's different than we're going to take them out, or U.S. imperialism is going to affect regime change, or any of those things. Well, yesterday, Joe Biden did an event where he announced his new budget and billionaire tax that we spoke about on the bonus show. He took about 10 or 11 questions from reporters, and almost all of them were versions of the same question. Wasn't it wrong for you to suggest you're going to take Putin out? And of course, that's not what Joe Biden said. So let's look at some of these examples. And this is a perfect example of, I know that these reporters understand that's not what Joe Biden meant. Joe Biden didn't say, I want to invade Russia. I want to remove Putin. I want to assassinate Putin, or any of these things. Joe Biden just said, this guy can't remain in power for the good of the world. Whoop, and I even lost my headphones because I'm gesticulating so wildly. So let's start with the first one here. Here is Kelly O'Donnell from NBC.
Kelly O'Donnell, NBC.
Thank you, Mr. President. Do you believe what you said? Thank you, sir. Do you believe what you said, that Putin can't remain in power? Or do you now regret saying that because your government has been trying to walk that back? Did your words complicate matters?
Well, you asked three different questions. I'll answer them all. Number one, I'm not walking anything back. The fact of the matter is, I was expressing the more outrage I felt toward the way Putin is dealing and the actions of this man, just brutality. Half the children in Ukraine. I just come from being with those families. But I want to make it clear, I wasn't then, nor am I now, articulating a policy change. I was expressing the moral outrage that I feel, and I make no apologies for it.
My
personal feelings. Secondly, you asked me about, what was the second part?
Complicate the diplomacy of this moment.
No, I don't think it does. You know, the fact is that we're in a situation where what complicates the situation of the moment is the escalatory efforts of Putin to continue to engage in carnage, the kind of behavior that that makes the whole world say, my.
All right. So I think you get the point. He's not saying there's a new policy. He's not saying we're invading Russia. He's not saying any of those things. He's just like, this guy can't remain in power. And this is really one of those cases where media is seizing on something and there's really nothing there. Next, we'll go to Peter Doocy from Fox, who, by the way, for all of the adversarial questions that Peter Doocy asks, Joe Biden keeps calling on him at almost every press avail. Let's listen.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I know you're going to ask a really nice question.
Well, it's an important question, no, I think. Are you worried that other leaders in the world are going to start to doubt that America is back if some of these big things that you say on the world stage keep getting walked back?
What's getting walked back?
It made it sound like, just in the last couple days, it sounded like you told U.S. troops they were going to Ukraine. It sounded like you said it was possible the U.S. would use a chemical weapon. And it sounded like you were calling for regime change in Russia. And we know...
None of the three occurred.
Mr. President?
You interpret the language that way. I was talking to the troops. We're talking about helping train the troops in... that are the Ukrainian troops that are in Poland. That's what the context. I sat there with those guys for a couple hours. That's what we talked about.
So when you said you're going to see when you're there, you were not intending
to... I was referring to meeting with and talking with the Ukrainian troops who are in Poland.
And when you said a chemical weapon use by Russia would trigger a response in kind...
It will trigger a significant response.
What does that mean?
I'm not going to tell you. Why would I tell you? You got to be silly.
The world.
Okay, so that's on the first two points. And then Biden again going on to address this question of regime change. You were calling for regime change. And of course, he was not. And every reporter asking this, it's like they smelled blood in the water and they could ask nothing else.
Back to your original words that he cannot remain in power. Can you help us understand, you have more foreign policy experience than any president who has ever held this office.
Right.
Whether those are your personal feelings or your feelings as president, do you understand why people would believe you, as someone commanding one of the largest nuclear arsenals in the world, saying someone cannot remain in power is a statement of U.S. policy? And also, are you concerned about propaganda use of those remarks by the Russians?
No and no.
Tell me why. You have so much experience. You are the leader of this country.
Because it's ridiculous. Nobody believes we're going to take down. I was talking about taking down Putin. Nobody believes that. Number one. Number two.
And I think he's right that even these reporters don't believe it. I don't think these reporters really believe Biden was saying we're going to go in and take Putin out and do regime change. He just said this guy can't stay in power.
What have I been talking about all since this all began? The only war that's worse than one intended is one that's unintended. The last thing I want to do is engage in a land war or a nuclear war with Russia. That's not part of it. I was expressing my outrage at the behavior of this man.
All right. So you guys get it. And this is the perfect story of the media driven narrative. When Joe Biden said this, had reporters not started going crazy saying, "Oh, sir, are you demanding regime change?" it never would have become a story. There's plenty to criticize Joe Biden about. This is not it. And it's almost a signal as to, I mean, listen, it wasn't even a slow news week. And yet still 7 out of the 10 questions or something were focused on this. Very strange stuff and not particularly informative to the American public. I want to do a little bit of a follow up about the Will Smith slap of Chris Rock during the Oscars on Sunday night. The American right wing seems to have lost its mind and are delivering bizarre take after take about what happened or what didn't actually happen on Sunday night. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of what my now having had a chance to think about it more, what my view is on what happened on Sunday night. For those of you who don't know, Chris Rock during the Oscars made a joke about Will Smith's wife's short hair, which is the style she chooses because she has alopecia, baldness. And Will Smith didn't like it. And he walked up to Chris Rock during the Oscars and slapped him in the face and then yelled, "Keep my wife's name out of your mouth." It was an insane situation. And I'm going to talk about my thoughts in a moment. But first, let me show you some just bizarre takes. Cultural critic and arbiter of ideas Dave Rubin said that if it had been a white person who did the slap, then everybody would have gone crazy, and he's mad about that. So he's upset about how people would have reacted in a different situation. It's sort of, what are you even talking about, dude?
But because they know no one's paying attention, would you put it above the machinery of Hollywood to fabricate something like this? That Chris Rock makes a fairly innocuous joke. I mean, she's got a shaven head, and I'll talk more about alopecia in a sec, as I said. And that Will Smith so loses control. He's laughing at the joke at first, that he so lost control of himself that on an evening where he knows millions, even though it's not as many millions as it used to be, millions of people are watching, that he so lost control of himself that he walks up on stage calmly. He didn't bum rush the stage, right? He walks up there, smacks the guy, and just sits down. No security came and got him.
So far, he's spot on. I like this analysis so far.
Nobody, you know, apparently during the commercials, there were some PR people saying something to him. But, you know, we could also add like the weird woke element of race to this. So it was black on black violence, which people obviously treat a little bit differently. I suspect that
woke element. What?
If Matt Damon had gotten out of the crowd, very pasty white Matt Damon had gotten out of the crowd and smacked Chris Rock, there would be riots in the streets.
Okay. So now it's just completely unhinged. Yeah. It's not going to be, if it was Matt Damon who slapped Chris Rock, you were not going to see the Rodney King riots or anything like that. So the woke aspect of this, just a bizarre take. He's mad about how people would have reacted to something that didn't happen. How is that a story? Then we go to Fox News, where Donald Trump's former press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, compared what happened to when Michelle Wolf joked about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and right-wingers were mad, and it has nothing to do with it whatsoever.
Would have stopped them, I would hope, but because he's Will Smith, they just don't?
Yeah, I think Trace made the key point. You know, if it was a fan, it'd be totally different treatment than it would be for a celebrity. And also, I think very different scenario when you think to, I couldn't get out of my head as I watched this, the White House Correspondents Association dinner from 2018, where Sarah Sanders was so maliciously attacked. You had Samantha Wolf, or B, whatever the heck her name is, Michelle Wolf, going after Sarah Sanders for her appearance. And minutes long, excruciating detail. And I watched Sarah Sanders sit there, my predecessor, with such grace and poise and kindness, and just sit there and take it. Because if you're a Republican woman, you got to take it. If you're a celebrity, you engage in this behavior and you'll have people come to your defense. Jamal Bowman, another congressman, came to the defense of Will Smith. You had a CNN commentator who actually blamed this on Donald Trump coming to Will Smith's defense. But if I just may make this one ancillary point, please. Just like I didn't like the jokes about Sarah Sanders, I did not like that joke about Will Smith's wife. I had a friend who I grew up with who had alopecia, and I just thought it was totally out of bounds.
Okay. So again, there, it really isn't, whatever point she's trying to make is not landing. And it's always somehow about wokeness and people and criticizing and double standards with conservatives. Last clip here. This is Sunny Hostin from The View, not a right winger per se, but sort of sometimes a contrarian on that show, or maybe compared to the others. In any case, she talks about how this is this was an instance of toxic masculinity.
And I think that when that type of thing, when you live publicly, you don't have the right to all of a sudden decide to execute violence. And I have to say, that was a show of toxic masculinity. If he was offended and felt emasculated by Regina Hall's joke or by Chris Rock's joke, you don't act out in violence. That is not a show of love. That's a show of violence. And okay. I think that...
And then lastly, Kyle Becker, the CEO of Becker News, a former Fox News producer, tweeting, if Will Smith was a white guy, he would have been let out of the Oscars in handcuffs. Then police would have thrown him in jail. There would be 1,000 media hit pieces about him being racist. He would be canceled for life. Instead, he won Best Actor. That's privilege. And of course, that's also untrue. Chris Rock declined to press charges, and that's sort of it. So I have to tell you, there are little pieces of what these people said that actually do make a lot of sense. What we have here was maybe a distasteful joke by Chris Rock, and then a physical attack. These are not on the same playing field. It's Will Smith is right to be completely humiliated by what he did. It's embarrassing, number one. Number two, even if indeed Will Smith was sort of standing up for his wife, She was not in any kind of physical danger, right? Physically slapping someone would be legitimate to stand up for your wife if it's a defense to a physical attack. There was no physical danger. And number three, it is notable that no security get involved in any way. Now, I know that it's easy to say, well, security would never think that Will Smith's going to slap Chris Rock. There's no reason that they would do that. Okay, but it is also kind of reflective more generally of the Academy staff did nothing to prevent this in any way. They didn't make any effort to explain why Will Smith stayed in the building after a physical attack. The physical attack is completely out of bounds. And as a big Will Smith fan myself, he should be completely humiliated by what happened here. At the end of the day, this whole thing about, well, the joke was very off color. I don't disagree. The joke was off color. You're sitting in the front row at the Oscars. This is what happens at the Oscars. There's a roast element. There's a roast aspect to this. These people make millions and millions of dollars. You can take a bad joke. You don't need to go and physically slap someone. And Will Smith is unilaterally in the wrong there. We'll have these clips on our Instagram at David Pakman Show, where you can also let me know your thoughts about my analysis. Today, we're going to be speaking with Claudia Golden, who's a professor of economics at Harvard University and author of the new book, Career and Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. It's really great to have you on today. I appreciate your time.
I'm pleased to be here.
So I think maybe to start our conversation, it might be interesting as you catalog in the book to talk about some of the catalysts over the last 100 years that have led women to enter the workforce in greater numbers now than at any previous time. Can you talk a little bit about kind of the main highlights on these last 100 years?
Certainly. So to begin with, in fact, the most important change in the labor force in almost every country in the world has been the increase of women in the workforce. So this decision is sort of made by considering what we call the opportunity cost of being in the household. So when paid work is more remunerative, it's worth more relative to home production, you exit that household and you go to work, you know. And this can come about because real wages increase. It can also come about because household production has better alternatives. All you have to think about is what it would be like to bake bread yourself rather than buying it. Of course, lots of people bake bread and they do a very good job. But it might also be furthered when social norms and traditions change. So you asked about the catalyst. So technological change of lots of different types did it. So the most important ones are the ones that decreased the importance of what we call brawn work. Now, I'm really strong. I'm stronger than my husband, I know, but there are a lot of men who are stronger than I am. And it increased the value of brain work. That's really very important. So, and then there are the technologies that made homes cleaner and their care less labor intensive. You know, we forget about the fact, we take for granted that we have clean water and sewage removal, we have flush toilets and central heating and household electricity. And finally, there are those that enabled women to control their fertility. It's really very, very important. And that led to an enormously large increase in the age of first marriage in as late as the 1970s, when the birth control pill finally diffused among young women. So those are the main ones.
You have spoken about, in the new book, you talk about the significantly increased rate of women who get college degrees. And at a very top level, we know that at least right now, this may change, but at least right now, people with college degrees have higher lifetime earnings. Can you talk a little bit about the educational component to this as well?
Sure. So I think that you're asking why it is that women versus men get more degrees. So the returns are extremely high. On the margin, all these, you know, the vast majority of individuals who don't get a college degree would do much better if they did. That's not true for everyone, but it's true on the margin. But first, a few important facts that are generally not known. There have been more female college graduates in the U.S. than male college graduates since around 1980. So therefore, it didn't happen yesterday. It didn't even happen 10 years ago. It began, believe it or not, 40 years ago. The second fact of importance is that when high school graduation was a really important milestone, and when just 10 to 20% of the nation's young people would cross that threshold, and I mean like in the first quarter century of the first quarter of the 20th century, women were the vast majority of high school graduates. Okay, that's an important fact. And the third fact is that there are more female than male college graduates in virtually all the rich countries in the world. And even in the poorer countries, women are increasing their numbers relative to men. So to understand what's going on, we have to take all of this into consideration. So two facts or two notions. The first is that work for men is still partially brawn driven. So guys can still do construction work. Go to any construction site. How many women do you see? Very, very few. And so men, even without a college degree, can still find work that we used to call good work. It's become less and less good, although the demand for non-college graduates today is very hard. And the second point is that men, let's call them males because most of them are very young, don't get their act together until later in life. And this is reflected in just a host of risky behaviors, from drugs to crime to those that result in their own bodily harm. And so those who study psychology and genetics can point to some of the underlying reasons. And it means that the boys don't write their college essays on time, and they don't apply on time, and they don't go.
When we talk about this issue with most Americans who are sort of centered in the political debates of our time, a lot of the factors that you're talking about to build up this foundation of our understanding of the dynamics of the workforce often get sort of tested by the final output, which is what does pay look like, and questions of pay disparity. And for a very long time, this idea of the 77 cents on the dollar was being floated about. About 8 years ago, we did a kind of deeper dive into this, and some of your research was actually part of what we use to figure out what a maybe more accurate number is. And it seems that the 77 cent number is simply not an accurate number. From what I'm recalling now from the research, it seemed to be closer to 92 cents on the dollar, some part of which might be due to discrimination. Can you talk a little bit about that piece?
Okay.
I know this is a huge can of worms. I understand.
As someone once said, a can of worms larger than the universe, yeah. Which is a little scary. So the first thing is that, first of all, it's not 77, it's 82, I believe. But it is an accurate number for something. Everything's an accurate number. If I told you the price of apples, you know, in the corner store, that would be an accurate number for the price of apples at the corner store. Maybe not be the correct number for the price of apples in San Diego or in Omaha. So that's part of the issue. So it is constructed by taking everyone in the current population survey, taking their weekly earnings for men and women, and using only those who are full-time year-round, so that sort of standardizes in some manner, not entirely, and then takes the median for women and the median for men and divides. That's a number. It's an accurate number for what it's doing. Okay, here's the inaccuracies. The inaccuracies are that for each woman, the amount that she receives relative to men changes over her lifetime. We know that. We know that for relatively young men and women, their earnings are pretty similar. You know, if I look at what happens to college graduates or law school graduates, when they first leave, their earnings are very similar. And then over time, they diverge, and they diverge a tremendous amount for those at the highest end the professionals. So lawyers, so two lawyers might both go to a Park Avenue law firm, and then they marry, they have kids, and they realize it's unsustainable. And so what happens is that it's often the case that the woman will remain a lawyer, but move to a firm that's smaller and less demanding, less greedy. The difference between their earnings, that ratio isn't 77, it's not 92, it's often 64, you know. But we generally don't observe in census data, since we're narrowing this, we're looking at the medians, these are the very, very upper tail. If we looked at the lower tail, then they're going to be far more similar. It's almost ironic. I've often been asked, isn't the gender gap wider at the bottom? And I said, I'm going to be wider at the bottom. We've got a bottom that's limited by the minimum wage. So it's not as if you have so much room at the bottom. You have a tremendous amount of room at the top. And so that's the issue. So it is a correct number, but it's not a number that's going to tell us a lot about what's happening to individuals as they go through their life cycle.
That's very interesting. So, and with your study being in economics, you're able to explore a number of different ways of measuring this, depending on what is the question that we are sort of trying to answer. And then it seems that a second layer on top of this would be, if one wants to ask political questions or societal questions about discrimination, we need to be very careful about what are the numbers that we're considering, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, it's my sense that there's no question that there are disparities that we should eliminate. There's sexual harassment. There's disparities in terms of the ability of individuals to go to a supervisor and ask for a raise. There's real discrimination. But it's my sense, and we have a lot of information that shows this, that even if we eradicated all of that, and I hope we do eradicate all of that, it's not going to close the gap, because much of the gap is due to this notion of greedy work and the fact that in couples that are different sex couples, they often abandon gender equity, as I just said with the couple who graduated from law school. And when they abandon couple equity, they throw gender equality under the bus with it.
When you in the book talk about various anti-discrimination laws, training for people in managerial and supervisory positions, my understanding and my reading of it is you do find that these initiatives are valuable, but that they're not necessarily enough. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say that it's not that they're not necessarily enough. They're not really getting to the main problem.
And when you, if we really want to fine tune or ascertain the problem, it seems there's a number of components to some degree. I mean, you talked about the dynamic within opposite sex couples and career choices that exist there. You talked about the difference between what we might consider higher wage jobs rather than middle or lower wage jobs. Can you talk to us about some of the other specific points that should be looked at when we are trying to identify exactly what the problem to be addressed is?
Certainly. So the problem in many ways is that work, a lot of work, is very greedy. And so when individuals, couples are making these choices, they can and they have care responsibilities. They can both take the more flexible job that allows them to respond to emergencies, that allows them a certain amount of flexibility without penalty. But if they do that and the world is very greedy, they're leaving a lot of money on the table. It's really as simple as that. Greedy jobs also impact those at the lower end, but that's a somewhat different story. But it's really the case that for many couples, they're faced with a difficult problem as to whose career is going to get the upper hand, let's say. But at the same time, there's no question that both members of the couple lose out, because men lose out of the joys and of seeing their family in the same amount of time that women do. And women lose out because their careers are in many ways lowered, and they're lowered for their lifetimes.
Last thing I want to ask about, programs like universal pre-K, publicly funded childcare, et cetera. It might seem as though if these are funded through taxes and they provide both parents, for lack of a better term, with a more equalizing opportunity to remain in the workforce in a more engaged way, it would seem as though programs like that might have an equalizing force. Is that the case?
Yeah. So let's think about it. There are three types of solutions. One is to lower the price of these flexible jobs, make them more productive. That's the one that I spend a lot of time on. The second one is to lower the price of care of children, of not just children, but of the elderly. And that's another set of issues. And the third type of solution is simply to change gender norms, because if in fact, when given this choice, it was random, then you might throw couple equity under the bus, but you wouldn't throw gender equality under the bus with it. Okay, but let's talk about you. It's a somewhat separate issue to talk about universal pre-K and public funded childcare. That would certainly change the price of care. It would drive it down relative to the amount that you get from working. By the way, it would also be the case that if we change tax policy, that might be a good thing to do too. So if we didn't have joint returns, as is the case in Britain and Sweden, then women wouldn't, in some sense, be faced within the family by the higher marginal tax rate. So that would be a very good thing too. But the problem is that someone has to pay for universal pre-K and child care. And the latter, child care, is extremely expensive, as anyone with children knows. I mean, everyone complains. It's very interesting that everyone with children complains about the high cost of child care. And at the same time, they complain that child care workers are paid too little. So.
Right. Where do you think the costs come from? Right.
It's a very, very simple point. If you have one child care worker for three children, just do the math. And it's very, very clear that if your child care worker is well educated, well skilled, and well paid, it's going to cost a tremendous amount. So these are decisions for the polity. Sweden decided that they did want to go that route, not for infants, by the way. For infants, one of the parents receives parental leave and is paid for that. So as researchers, though, we can demonstrate that pre-K increases the human capital of the next generation versus pre-K. You didn't say pre-K, you said universal, and that's important. By involving the entire community is actually more effective than targeted pre-K. So that's sort of the answer. Universal pre-K would be very, very nice. I mean, let's face it. We have public education. At what age should it begin? You know, at some point in the 1920s, 1930s, it was decided that we should push it to 5 years old or 6 years old and have this thing called kindergarten. At some point in the 20th century, we had universal kindergarten. So So there's no, this is a matter of the age. Three-year-olds, four-year-olds can learn.
Right.
And so, yes, spoken as someone who has a four-year-old.
The new book is Career and Family, Women's Century-Long Journey Toward Equity. We've been speaking with the book's author, Harvard University economics professor Claudia Golden. I really appreciate your time and your insights today.
Well, thanks very much, David. I've enjoyed it.
I want to do a kind of close the loop on a story we've been covering, which is this U.S. trucker convoy. Now, you might be saying, David, the trucker convoy, wasn't that like months ago in Canada? Or did the U.S. convoy even actually get started? And you would be right to be confused because they accomplished absolutely nothing. They got almost no attention. They were protesting non-existent mandates, and it is now coming to a close. This is, I have to tell you, I love this. I take so much pleasure in this. Good Daily Beast report. People's convoy gives up and will leave D.C. after 3 weeks of doing absolutely nothing. Our friend Zachary Patrizzo wrote this for the Daily Beast, and he explains, 3 weeks after the so-called People's Convoy landed in Washington, D.C., the group is calling it quits after accomplishing nothing except injuring residents and circling the Beltway. Co-organizer Mike Landis announced Sunday night that the group would pack its things up in the coming days and drive back to California. Landis said the convoy goers who remain in Hagerstown, Maryland, who had freezing nights while camping out, will enjoy a southerly route back to California. We're going to take a little more southern route, so it's a little warmer than this. This is absolutely fantastic. Now, a lot of you are probably reacting by saying, I didn't even know that they were still there. And indeed, they did nothing. Now, there's two parts to this. The first part is, even when the Canadian trucker convoy got going, they were mostly protesting non-existent mandates. And since then, even more vaccine requirements have been dropped. Now, in the United States, the U.S. trucker convoy is quite literally protesting for freedom that they have. I mean, there's almost no vaccine requirements remaining for people who are within the United States. If their own company requires them to be vaccinated or tested, that's their company policy. The Supreme Court already said that Joe Biden forcing companies with over 100 employees to require vaccination or testing had to be halted. So at its core, this was a movement about something that is not actually a problem. But the second part of this that I find just particularly funny is these are people who were, I don't want to call it rallying. They were basically driving around, framing themselves as the victims of government tyranny. And as their convoy started to come east from the West Coast, Russia invades Ukraine. Civilians are being killed. It's a complete violation of the sovereignty of Ukrainian borders, et cetera, et cetera. And these truckers are trying to say they're the ones that are being victimized by tyranny. Like, it's what's happening in Ukraine is absolutely horrifying. Just one of the most horrible things that's happened in the last couple of years. But there's some hilarious irony to the fact that when there are real victims of government authoritarianism, I'm talking about Ukrainian victims of Putin's authoritarianism and belligerence, you've got truckers who are like, I don't want to get vaccinated. I don't want to get vaccinated. The big headlines from the trucker convoy, about a week ago, someone on a bicycle got in front of the convoy and almost shut the entire thing down. They didn't even know how to get around the biker. And it barely got any attention. They accomplished nothing. And the entire reason for being was bogus, given the reduction in all sorts of different mask, vaccine, and testing requirements in the United States. Let's hope that we're closing the book on this pathetic excuse for activism that is actually just a waste of everyone's time and particularly inconvenient to people who are just trying to get to work and earn a living. One of the things we did not get to cover yesterday when we covered the wacky weekend in Georgia with Trumpists and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and all of these other people was that John Bachman, a Newsmax host. I'm not very familiar with John Bachman. John Bachman was allowed, I guess, to interview Donald Trump right before his speech on Saturday. It is a bizarre interview. Trump looks visibly confused. He doesn't seems disoriented. And the things he's saying make just as little sense as Trump's physical appearance. Let's take a look at this. Trump just uncontrollably lying and even seems confused about the lies he's telling.
Let's talk about this lawsuit against Hillary Clinton. What do you hope to accomplish with that?
Well, they spied on my campaign. You had all of them there.
Remember, there is still no proof that anybody spied on his campaign.
All the names are there, all the names you've been reading about for years. Bill Barr didn't want to be impeached, and so therefore he decided not to do it, which was a shame because, frankly, you know, you need courage to fight these people, deep state or whatever you want to call them. But
Trump still talking about the deep state. I mean, fully in to so many of these different conspiracy theories.
I think we're going to do very well with it. We have a great lawsuit, and I felt it was really very important to bring it because think of it. If I spied on their campaign, can you imagine what would happen, John?
Now, remember, the lawsuit, as we talked about yesterday, will go nowhere. If the lawsuit were to proceed, Trump would be subject to discovery. And the last thing Trump would ever allow is for himself to be put under oath and deposed. It's just the lawsuit's going nowhere. You guys know that.
Spied on their campaign on Obama or Biden or on Hillary Clinton. And the same thing happened where we caught him because we caught him red handed. If that ever happened, what are they talking about? Treason? Are they talking about the rest of your life in jail? Are they talking about death penalty? And these people can't be allowed to get away with this stuff.
Right. So Trump suggesting that something that didn't happen is actually treason. Trump then seemingly blaming Joe Biden for Putin maybe using nukes. I mean, this is bizarre stuff.
Let's also talk about Russia and Ukraine. Seems like Putin may have miscalculated there. What is your assessment of where things stand right now with Putin's invasion of Ukraine?
Well, you never know. I can tell you the country is just in shambles. You look at these cities, they've been bombed and they've been blown up, and it's going to take 50 to 100 years to rebuild them. And so many people have been killed. So many people have been killed and horribly wounded. But I will tell you that it should have never happened. This would have never happened had the election not been rigged. This would have never happened. He would have never in a million years have done it. So it's very sad. When I watch it, it's sad because this is something all those people should be living now. They should not be dead.
Do you think Putin would use nuclear weapons?
When you put him into a corner and when you talk the way they're talking, you know, they're talking weak and yet they're almost giving him an incentive. They're handling him very badly, in my opinion. I think that Biden apologized again today. He's apologized every time he makes a speech. He apologizes 3-4 times a day for everything he says. Look, we have people that don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. So anyway, if Putin uses nuclear weapons, it is not going to be Joe Biden's fault. And then lastly, Trump commenting on approval ratings.
I have no idea if he's going to run. I can't imagine he does well. He's got the lowest approval rating in history, in the history of a president, which is pretty low. And if he does, and if I decide I'd love to run against him, I can tell you who would be better.
Now, of course, Donald Trump's approval ratings at this point in his presidency were lower than those of Joe Biden. So quite literally all lies. It's lies all the way down. And Trump just is seeming very confused when you look at him and when you listen to him. It's all very bizarre. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192-DAVID-P. Our friend Billy Harrison called in. He really thinks Keystone XL would lower gas prices. Listen to this.
David Pacman.
Yeah.
Billy Harrison again. You're saying President Biden, or any president for that matter, has nothing to do with the price of gas.
Almost nothing to do. I've explained the three things presidents can do.
So, I've called you several times to debate. Seems like you never play my clips.
I actually have played a number of Billy's clips.
My voicemail on your show. I wouldn't either if I was you because I'd make you look stupid.
Right.
But, Mr. President has nothing to do with gas prices. Yet, Joe Biden, first day in office, counts the Keystone Pipeline. That's one way he affects the gas prices.
Yeah. No, unfortunately, that's not true. Remember, Keystone Pipeline phases 1 through 3 are up and running. What Joe Biden did was stop construction of the fourth phase of Keystone XL. Keystone is not an oil field. It's only a pipeline. It's a way to transport the oil. The oil is still coming in. It's just coming in through other means. And the best estimates we have are that phase four of Keystone XL, when completed, and it wouldn't even be done now, if Biden had started continued construction, it wouldn't even be done now. But when completed, phase four of Keystone XL would only have increased oil production by 1%, would have no impact on the price of gas. Sorry, Billy. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com to get in.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
The signals we hear from the negotiating platform positive, but these signals do not drown out the blows of Russian shells.
As the outlines of a possible peace deal emerge, Ukraine has offered to become a neutral country and remain nuclear free in exchange for security guarantees. But Ukrainian officials say a deal can only be reached once Russia withdraws its forces. We'll go to Kyiv to speak with Peter Zalmayev, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Then, as the U.S. announces it'll welcome up to 100,000 Ukrainian refugees fleeing the Russian invasion, immigration officials say they're preparing for a surge of migrants and increasing detentions at the U.S.-Mexico border. We'll speak with Ghislaine Joseph of the Haitian Bridge Alliance about how Haitian refugees are treated, and with award-winning journalist Marina Hossa about the Haitians she met in a migrant caravan.
In the U.S. media, they're portrayed like they're forcing their way into the United States or trying to intimidate Americans. But in fact, what I see is a very different narrative of a caravan. This is a caravan of love, safety, and security.
We'll also look at how the Western world has turned its back on the horrific conditions African migrants face in, among other places, inside Libyan detention centers, documented in a new book by Sally Hayden called My Fourth Time, We Drown, Seeking Refuge on the World's Deadliest Migration Route. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations says more than 4 million refugees have now fled Ukraine as Russia's invasion nears its sixth week. On Tuesday, Russia announced plans to, quote, fundamentally cut back military operations near Kyiv and the city of Chernihiv, but the claim was greeted by deep skepticism from Ukraine. Officials in Chernihiv say Russian forces carried out strikes through the night while air raid sirens repeatedly went off in Kyiv. On Tuesday, at least 12 people died and 33 were injured in the southern city of Mykolaiv after a Russian rocket hit a government building, leaving a gaping hole in the nine-story structure. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has accused Russia of using banned anti-personnel landmines in the eastern Kharkiv region. This comes as the outlines of a possible peace deal have emerged. Ukraine has offered to become a neutral country and remain nuclear-free in exchange for security guarantees. But Ukrainian officials said a deal could only be reached once Russia withdraws its forces.
So, in order for this agreement to be valid and for all sides to agree on it, there has to be full peace on Ukraine's territory. No foreign troops. All have to leave.
CNN is reporting U.S. troops in Poland are providing weapons instruction to Ukrainian soldiers as the Biden administration continues to funnel anti-tank missiles, machine guns, grenade launchers, and drones into Ukraine. President Biden hinted at the training efforts Monday.
We're talking about helping train the troops in that are the Ukrainian troops that are in Poland.
A top UN official in Ukraine is calling for a probe into Ukrainian and Russian forces mistreating prisoners of war. One widely circulated video appears to show Ukrainian soldiers shooting three hooded Russians in their legs. The video also shows Ukrainian soldiers kicking and hitting the captive Russians, some of whom are bleeding. In other news, the CDC and FDA have given approval for a second COVID-19 booster shot for all adults in the